I know that Supervisor Sperring or Commissioner Sperring would be very upset if we start any later than this. He always starts exactly on time. Yeah, so let's sit down and see if we can conduct business. Thank you for being here.
He and Scott are driving up from Monterey this morning, so they should be here, depending on commute, anytime.
Well, he called me to tell me that he wasn't going to be here, so that's why I was starting.
When did he say that?
Yesterday or the day before.
Last night they said they were coming.
Oh, well. I don't think we should wait for him. He wouldn't wait for us. So anyway, so I think in order to have a quorum, though, we need to have our chair and vice chair join the committee. And so if that is the case, can we determine whether there is a quorum?
Would you like me to go ahead and do a roll?
And yes,
we'll
go
establish
ahead.
From there? Okay. Commissioner Aguirre, absent. Commissioner Azambrato, absent. Commissioner Jacopini, present. Commissioner Haggerty, absent. Commissioner Halstead?
Here.
Commissioner Kinsey, absent. Commissioner Liccardo, absent. Commissioner Pierce?
Here.
Commissioner Spearing, absent. We do not have a quorum at this time.
Can we ask our chair and vice chair to serve as ex officio?
Yes, that's fine, and you need to deputize one other member.
Who would like to be our Commissioner Bates? Yes. Thank
all right,
you.
So the chair, vice chair, and
Commissioner
Bates
are join the meeting.
And Madam Chair, ABAG does not yet have a quorum as well.
I'm told that you do not need to vote on these issues.
We have minutes to vote on.
Should
from
we?
Our last meeting. So when
is
we
there
get
any
a quorum, when, no. When Commissioner Sperring and Haggerty get here, we'll be okay.
We'll be okay. All right.
Chair,
well,
they're on their way from
Monterey. Madam Chair, you can find out from the Secretary how many people you need to deputize. You have three candidates right here that could easily be deputized, and you'd have a quorum.
I don't think we can do it for ABAG. We can do it for us. We're done.
Oh, well.
We're constituted. Thank you. So I think we're now in the position where we can pledge allegiance. So I wonder, can we stand and take action on that?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And then we will proceed to the all-important compensation announcement.
As authorized by state law, I am making the following announcement. Each member of the board here today will be entitled to receive $100 per meeting attended, up to a maximum of $500 per month per agency. This amount is provided as a result of convening a meeting for which each member is entitled to collect such amount.
Thank you very much. Next on the agenda is the consent calendar, which is comprised of the minutes of the March 13th meeting. Are there any corrections or additions, or if there are none, is there a motion?
So moved. Second.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, we consider that unanimously approved. Thank you very much. Item 5, Plan Bay Area Update, Committed Projects and Fund Policy. I think that Adam Nolting and Bill Bacon will be presenting.
Good morning. I'm Adam Nolting with MTC's Planning Section. With me this morning is Bill Bacon with MTC's Programming and Allocation Section to present Item 5, the Committed Policy for the Update of Plan Bay Area. As background, the Commission approved MTC Resolution 4006 to establish the Committed Policy for Plan Bay Area in 2011. An overview of the Committed Policy from MTC Resolution is included in the background section of the Executive Director's Memorandum included in your agenda packets. Today, staff seeks the MTC Planning Committee's review and referral of the Committed Projects and Funds Policy for Plan Bay Area 2040, MTC Resolution 4182. For Plan Bay Area 2040, MTC proposes to maintain the policy framework from Plan Bay Area's Committed Policy. Several modifications to the policy have been proposed and identified on page 2 of the Executive Director's Memorandum. This morning's presentation is intended to walk you through Attachment A of MTC Resolution 4182. The purpose and intent of the committed policy, as stated on the next slide, remains the same as Plan Bay Area, and as noted, is intended to, first, determine which projects are subject to a project performance evaluation and or subject to discretionary action by the Commission, and second, to determine which projects, or excuse me, which fund sources are subject to discretionary action by the commission. As with Plan Bay Area, projects that are 100% locally funded are considered committed and therefore not subject to a project performance evaluation. All other projects that are not fully funded and sufficiently advanced in the project development process will undergo a project performance assessment. The results of the project performance evaluation will be presented to the committee for its review. In addition to being 100% locally funded, a project may be deemed committed if it meets the following two requirements. The project has certified environmental documentation, including an environmental impact report or an environmental impact statement, by September 30th of 2015, the close of the call for projects. And secondly, the project has a documented full funding plan. In addition to projects, the committed policy also identifies which regional programs and regional funding programs are deemed committed. The second part of the committed policy defines committed funds. In summary, the committed policy states that committed funding is directed to a specific entity or for specific purposes as mandated by statute or by the administrating agency. And discretionary funding is defined as subject to MTC programming decisions, subject to compliance with commission allocation conditions, or is subject to competitive state and federal funding programs, often involving MTC advocacy. Locally generated and locally subvened funds stipulated by statute and funds directed to a specific entity or purpose as mandated by statute or by the administering agency are deemed committed funds. And this is inclusive to actions taken by the Commission or other approving agencies prior to Plan Bay Area 2040's adoption in June 2017. In Table 3, which begins on page 2 of Attachment A, list Plan Bay Area 2040's fund sources and their committed status. On Tuesday, MTC presented the committed projects and funds policy to the Regional Advisory Working Group, also known as ROG. In response to the discussion at ROG, MTC staff has proposed a minor revision to Table 2B in Attachment A of MTC Resolution 4182. Table 2B identifies the regional funding programs. And before you this morning is a memorandum detailing the minor revision. As noted in the memorandum, the revision is to reflect funding programs that currently have commission approval. As previously stated, regional funding programs approved between now and the adoption of Plan Bay Area 2040 will be considered committed once commission action has taken. The next steps for the committed policy process will begin in May. MTC staff will begin the project update and call for projects process to collect candidate project information for Plan Bay Area 2040. This effort will be coordinated with the baseline needs assessments. Similar to Plan Bay Area, CMAs will be asked to coordinate the call for projects within their respective counties. Alternatively, MTC will work directly with transit operators to collect and analyze operating and capital needs and revenues. We will also use data in the 2014 statewide needs assessments for local streets and roads assessments. Guidance for both the call for projects and needs assessments processes will be provided to project sponsors and to transit operators prior to May. As a reminder, all projects that will be seeking future regional, state, and or federal funds must be submitted for consideration in Plan Bay Area 2040. In addition, staff encourages project sponsors to submit candidate projects that support Plan Bay Area's performance targets and support the region's sustainable community strategy. The needs assessment processes will be conducted in parallel to the project update and call for projects and are intended to analyze the costs and revenues to operate the existing transportation system. The transit needs assessment will analyze the costs and revenues to operate transit service at their existing levels, as well as preserve and maintain the transit infrastructure. In closing, MTC staff recommends that the MTC Planning Committee approve and refer MTC Resolution Number 4182 as updated and presented, which establishes the committed projects and funds policy for Plan Bay Area 2040, to the Commission for approval at their April 22nd meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a couple of people from the public who would like to speak. I wonder if we could take them before we go to commissioner questions.
I think one of them's on six.
Not five. You're right. Just one then. Thank you. So if there's no objection, I will ask that Speaker Clarissa Kambansagan to come forward. Thank you.
Good morning, commissioners, directors, and staff. My name is Clarissa Cobbinsagan. I am a community planner with Transform. First off, I want to thank staff for the improvements made to the committed projects policy. Maintaining that a committed project is one that has full funding and a certified EIR, EIS. We think that it is an appropriate advancement that those that have had status changes require further assessment. And of course, Transform thinks it would be spectacular if all projects were subject to performance assessment so we could see which ones are really moving us toward our regional goals and which ones are moving us away. But we recognize that this is a much better state in terms of the policy than we've had in previous cycles of the RTP. I just want to reiterate how the Bay Area's project performance assessment is one that is held up nationally as a model, and we hope that we would continue in that ensuring that the progress that we've made thus far continues on to the future. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we'll move to commission and ABAG questions, I guess. Commissioner Pierce.
Oh, sorry. Didn't.
Okay. All right. So is there, I see no questions. Commissioner Chair Cortez.
Commissioner Spong. A question for whoever wants to answer it. I see, just like everyone else, the proposed modifications. What I'm not clear on is the dates. I mean, once you get past number one, where it speaks to September 30th, 2015, are we to understand that the 2011 dates just stay intact from the old program, if you will?
I believe the September 30th, 2015 date is the only date included in the materials.
Yeah, so under number one, which is dealing with EIR and EIS, you know, instead of saying May 1st, 2011 would be the cutoff date, we now have September 30th, 2015. So it means, to me, more recent EISs and EIRs are now going to make projects eligible, right?
That is correct.
Over the last 4 years. But I'm not clear that, and maybe there's a good reason for it. Obviously, regional programs number four may already take into account, you know, 2015 project readiness from the original criteria. But two and three, is there any impact to leaving those at 2011? I mean, somebody comes along and says, well, yeah, since 2011, you know, we have project X, Y, and Z that would have met criteria in two and three, or is that just impossible to happen? That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, let me clarify. And this is, I guess, who could have proposed this or presented this a little bit differently. The one through four you're referring to are actually from the previous resolution. And so what we've done for the new resolution 4182 is actually simplified all one through four into one category.
Okay.
So in attachment A, and I apologize for this, under policy elements, which would be on, it's like on your first page that has some yellow strike through.
Yeah.
On the bottom under number one, we've actually removed the one through three and combined those into item one now. So it would read, project has a certified environmental impact report and EIS by September 30th. And then so the twos and threes that were on the previous resolution have actually been condensed into just that first item.
So that September 30th date supersedes the old 2011 dates.
That's correct.
Which would be the answer to my question.
Yeah.
Thank you for clarifying that. What other is it? I mean, I know there's a lot of, you just gave a whole PowerPoint and there's a lot of redlining or yellow highlighting here, but is there a concise way to say what the most significant change is from, besides condensing the criteria, you know, which is both cosmetic and changes the date?
Yeah, and I think
what's the big thing here? If there was, you know, one big thing you wanted to call out to everyone and say, make sure you're noticing this because we changed something significant, what would that be?
Well, I think we really did try to maintain the same policy framework as the last committed policy. So there isn't a lot of wholesale changes to the policy at all. I think on the first page you'll note that there is an added text that we did note that if a project's funding status does change over time, that they would then need to go to a project performance assessment when that comes up. But I think what you're seeing in most of the yellow highlighting throughout the document is simply just reflections of changes in either funding programs through the state and federal level, as well as some additional regional and local ones, as well as just updates to regional funding programs where we've had some additions to new programs here at MTC, as well as the operations program. So really it's just updating the current status of different programs and funding programs, and that's really been the main changes. I think in terms of the policy itself, it really does maintain the Plan Bay Area spirit and moving forward.
My recollection is that the process that you just described for changes in funding was really the intent in the past was that that would be almost an appeal process, an opportunity for an entity to come forward and say, look, our funding has changed, or we can't demonstrate full funding at the moment, but we want to be further assessed by MTC because we think we should still qualify. Is that a fair statement? Or?
Well, I think what we'll be trying to capture this summer through the call for projects is we'll be asking project sponsors to submit project information to us. Part of that will be gathering the committed status essentially by asking some questions, and if they can present, project sponsors can present to us a full funding plan, they will then be determined that they're committed at moving at from that point moving forward. So in some cases, if a project in the previous plan was committed, there is a chance it may not be committed moving into the next plan cycle. If their funding has changed and costs have changed, there may be a chance that there is a funding gap and they would not have a full funding plan.
But they get the opportunity of a performance assessment at that point? That's what I was getting at.
Yes, they do.
It almost functions as an appeals process.
Yes.
If you will. Okay, thank you. I'm clear.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions from the commission? This item will be forwarded to the commission, as I understand, for approval. So seeing none, is there a motion, or do we need a motion to forward it?
Still deputized. We've got a quorum, natural quorum.
Do we have a real quorum? Perhaps. Sparing and Haggerty, yes. And Commissioner Sparing asked that I continue for the moment. He'll correct me, of course, if I...
Madam Chair, I would move approval.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. Is there any objection? Seeing none, we will move forward to the Commission with this agenda item. Thank you. Yes. We'll move forward to the Commission. Item number 6, Plan Bay Area Forecast and Modeling Approach. Cynthia Kroll of ABAG will present.
Madam Chair, I would like to provide a short intro to the forecast modeling just to explain how this fits in the overall Plan Bay Area. As you know, Plan Bay Area update will be approved in 2017. That's more than 2 years from now. We expect for the forecast work, we still have 9 months ahead. So what we're bringing to you is the basic models, some of the basic research and analysis that will inform the forecast that will go into Plan Bay Area update. There is a letter that was submitted that we received yesterday with some concerns about addressing the BIA settlement. We're fully aware that there's a legal settlement, and we'll be addressing that in the fall, and that's what we have communicated to BIA in the past. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Miriam, and good morning, everyone. Can you hear me clearly? Okay. All right. So what I'd like to do today is just give you an overview of how we're approaching the regional forecast and answer any questions that you may have. I'm going to start with just talking about what the intention is of doing this forecast. And our main goal at the regional level is to produce a realistic forecast, a 25-year outlook from today, that's based on national and international trends. So there's only so much that we can do locally if the national and international economy don't cooperate, and we are certainly an area that grows based on the kinds of trends that happen internationally and nationally. So that's the basis for the regional outlook. We will estimate 2040 totals for population, jobs, households, and income at probably four different levels for the region as a whole. Then our next task is to distribute these forecasts geographically throughout the region. And that distribution is based partly on market factors, but also on local policy choices that the individual jurisdictions make. Then the other thing I want to mention is that, yes, this is a 25-year outlook from today, but obviously we revise it frequently. In the past, it's been done every 2 years. At this point, because it's done in sync with the SCS, the forecast is being revised every 4 years and perhaps more frequently if the need is seen to do that. So why do we have a regional forecast? That's another question we've been asked. Why not just use forecasts that other organizations like the Department of Finance do? And by doing a regional forecast for ABAG, we can get internally consistent estimates of population, jobs, households, and income in a way that we can't get if we just use others that are made, although we certainly take account of other forecasts, and indeed our regional forecast is built off of national expectations. The other reason it's helpful to have a regional forecast, there are a few other reasons. One is that it provides a context for local general planning efforts. When a local jurisdiction does a general plan, they're planning for what they think will happen in the future, and this provides a context for that, not only for their own community, although we do in the end give forecasts for each jurisdiction, but also helps them understand where their community sits in the context of the region as a whole. Then, obviously, it's needed for planning and financing transportation and housing investments, and we are providing the regional totals for Plan Bay Area. So how do we do the forecast? There are several pieces to this forecast. Within doing the regional forecast, there are three elements. We have a population model, an economic model, and a household module. Then once we have those regional numbers, we have an iterative process that will produce the geographic distribution. And that process will involve a model that provides the details. UrbanSim is the model that we are working with that's actually being run by MTC, so that part of the effort is very much a joint effort. We will do some other sub-regional estimates as well that will be used to validate what UrbanSim is coming up with. But another thing that's really important in this process is input from local agencies to make sure we're working with the right data and that what we're coming out with makes sense. And there's also opportunities for public review as we go through that process. And then that information is provided to MTC to run their travel demand model and also ultimately to do the greenhouse gas estimates, which are part of what the SCS requires. So in beginning this process, I wanted to understand just how well projections by ABAG had done in the past in terms of whether they'd hit the mark or not. So I'm going to run you through some historic projections, first for population and then for the economy, because they're quite instructive in terms of what we face going forward on this round. So here are the actual census numbers through 2010 for population, and the first two forecasts I'll show you are for 1987 and 1992. And you can see that 87 was slightly low for 1990 and stayed a little bit below the trend for the full period for which they projected. They were only projecting for 15 years at that point. They didn't have quite as demanding a task as we have now, but they also had very different tools. In 1992, obviously they were right on the mark for 1990 and did quite well for 95. But after that, they didn't anticipate the downturn that happened following the dot-com bust. And so they were a little bit off, but not much. I mean, these forecasts are pretty close. So then let's go on to 96 and 2002. Again, they ended up pretty close to what actually happened in, well, for 96, for 2000, and 2005, and 2010 for 2002. It's a shorter time frame we're comparing it to. And they continue to project out pretty much at the existing long-term trend. When we compare the 2013 population forecast to that, it's slightly below for the earlier years, and I think we find when we look at it now that it is actually low for 2015, although not much, because 2014 was probably about where 2015 is right now. And but then it goes up and it hits that trend line. So that's what happened with population projections. They vary a little, and we see a little bit of variation from the long-term trend line in population. But overall, those projections are pretty close. So now we come to employment, and here's employment history, and that 2015 number is actually the 2014 BLS numbers. And to start with, I should say, it's not that easy to even know what you're measuring when you're measuring employment. So the numbers you have up here are close to what ABEG and MTC use, which is the Bureau of Labor Statistics number with self-employment added onto it. And you can see it's much more volatile than population, and this is 10-year increments. It doesn't even include the housing boom and bust in it, or at least not the housing bubble part of it. So how well did they do? Here's 1987 and 1992, and 1987 did pretty well until the dot-com bust came, and then it was quite a bit higher. 1992, again, obviously met 1990 numbers, but and pretty much followed the projections that 87 were giving, again, totally missing the downturn, the fact that the dot-com upturn was a bubble and that downturn. And then if we add 96 and 2002, we can see that upward trend just keeps continuing. And so if you look at long-term trends, which is what the red line is, as composed to what was being predicted, we really have a history of over-predicting population or over-predicting employment for a long time. And then we put in the 2013 numbers, and that's the first in a long time that really recognized that when you look at the trend, you have to look at the down part as well as the up part and take the difference. So that's basically what 2013 does. Again, it predicts actually a little bit above this long-term trend, but it's pretty close to that now. Of course, it's hard to say if that's the right long-term trend. So why are employment forecasts less accurate? First of all, they predict on long-term trends, but when you're judging if they're accurate or not, you're looking at a short-term period in the cycle. So the past trends depend on whatever starting point and ending point you work with, which can vary a lot, and then your accuracy judgment depends on just where in the cycle you're judging they are. So it's harder to tell how accurate we are, but it's you can see from those earlier that earlier slide, we were clearly high for a number of different forecasts. Then, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's not that easy to measure employment. What are you actually talking about? Are you talking about one job per person, which is really what MTC wants to work with? So that's what the ABAG numbers have been in the past. But we know there are people who have two or three part-time jobs. Are you talking about part-time or full-time jobs? And different agencies provide different information at different levels of timeliness. And then finally, they tend to provide the data at a fairly aggregate level, mostly by what are called metropolitan statistical areas. So even when you just go down to the county level, the data accuracy is weaker. And this has been a problem in the past for our smaller counties. And So that affects how we're able to distribute the employment. And then beyond that, there's a lot of geographic uncertainty going forward. You know, the region may be pretty strong at new innovation, but where will that happen? Where will the hot spot be? Could we have predicted that San Francisco would be a hotter spot than Silicon Valley for some of these tech innovations that have happened? So it's challenging going forward, and we're having a lot of fun playing with it, trying to figure out what actually is a reasonable forecast. So we have modified the approach that was taken in 2013 as compared to what we're doing for this. 2013, the approach really started with the employment projection, and the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy used their shift-share approach, and you can see it was much closer, at least, to historic trends. Time will tell whether it's closer to those that are coming forward. And then they projected population, the totals, based on the assumption that, okay, we're going to have this many jobs, we need this many people to fill the jobs, and based on the expected distribution, demographic distribution that the Department of Finance is forecasting, these would be the overall numbers of people. So the population was directly driven by that employment growth. The household projection was estimated to accommodate population, really based on household size expectations. And then the geographic distribution was done in a way that matched jobs and population to where historic development had been and the ways that businesses or populations or cluster. So that's what was done in 2013. We are starting a little bit differently. We are initially projecting population and employment separately, and I'll go through what the process we're using for those, so I'm not going to say a lot about that with this slide. But population, as a result, doesn't just fall out of employment, although one portion of population growth is the migration component is clearly influenced by what happens with employment, and we are more directly trying to project what that migration component is. So because we're starting with two different models, then we have to reconcile them. Then from the population and employment numbers that we get, we will be able to estimate households and incomes, and the geographic distribution that will be done will at least partly rely on the statistical relationships that UrbanSim provides. But clearly those are both embedded in the model and beyond the model, we'll be looking at policy issues. So let me say, if I have time, let me say a few words about each of these pieces of our approach. Starting with population, we are working with a model that was developed by John Pitkin and Dowell Myers. And our idea with the population model is to really take into account how population grows by a lot of different characteristics. I mean, basically, there are two ways that population can grow. It can either grow from the people who are here, more babies are born, some people die, that's called, if you add all the change up together, that's called natural increase, or it can grow or decline because some people move in and some move out, and that's called net migration. You add those together and you get population change. So if you have a model built on that, that's called the natural increase part is called a cohort survival model, and that's really what Pitkin and Myers have developed. With migration patterns calculated as much by the, really in a cohort survival method as well. So they look at what those ethnic groups have done in the past. And their model is very takes into account that natural increase and migration vary depending on the ethnic characteristics of the population, the country of origin of an individual, and the age of an individual. So all of those pieces are taken into account as we look at how the Bay Area will change in the future. And as I said, not only is natural increase sensitive to those things, but migration is sensitive to those as well. The one weakness of their model is that they really don't have an economic component. So we then will use information from our economic model to further inform the economic portion of migration. So if you look at these different components of population growth, the blue is the natural increase, and you can see that's pretty steady and pretty predictable. But you can see overall the amount of change is not as predictable, and that the biggest variation is in what we call domestic migration, people moving from here to other parts of the U.S. or from other parts of the U.S. into the Bay Area. And it may surprise you to see that that net effect has been negative for every five-year period through 2010. We actually think it's turned positive in the last 5 years, but that's quite unusual. And then foreign migration is a little bit more steadier than the domestic, but it is sensitive to economic conditions as well, so that foreign migration into the movement into the Bay Area was reduced both in the 2000 to 2005 period and post 2008 when construction really dried up. So one of the features that Dowell and Myers really introduced was the varying fertility rates by ethnic groups and by nativity, so that they take into account over time if the proportion of the population that's foreign-born shifts over time, the overall fertility rate of that population group, that ethnic group, will also shift over time, so that we see declining fertility rates among Hispanic and Asian populations as more and more are native-born. You can see there are very big differences in birth rates and in migration by ethnic groups that have to be taken into account as well. So moving on to the economic forecast, we are making use of REMI, which is a nationwide set of regional econometric models. We've had one that's designed for the Bay Area particularly, and that will enable us to forecast gross regional product, employment by place of work, the population. It does its own population forecast, so that gives us a way of calibrating with the Dowell-Myers or the Pitkin and Myers model. Gives us labor force participation rates, and as a result, we can work out income from all of this. It's not the only tool we use. We are looking at alternative comparisons, including talking with the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy. And as I said, we'll be doing in-house reconciliation with the population model. This is a diagram of the REMI model. It has a number of different components. The ones outlined in red are the key ones that are of importance to the ABAG forecast. So just a couple of images to show you that will help explain some of the challenges we face in understanding what's happening with the economy. One is to really looking forward to find a balance among the economic drivers. Some of our economic drivers, professional and business services, information services, are very volatile, and we can't just project that they're going to continue as they have in the past, and our share of those industries within the nation have also historically been declining, and so one of the questions we have to deal with is whether that will continue, level off, or reverse. And then, of course, there are other types of jobs that grow basically as the population grows. So we're balancing all of those factors together. And then in terms of population growth associated with employment growth, that partly depends on how many people in your population now are actually working in the region, participating in the labor force. And the Bay Area has a very different labor force participation rate history than other parts of the nation and even other parts of the state. And so we have to take that into account, too, as we're looking at expectations for future growth. So we've done a lot so far on those two pieces of the model. We are really just beginning to work on the household module. We have it sketched out. Our primary approach with this module is to take into account, of course, the population forecast that we have, which will be broken out by age, ethnicity, place of origin, and use that information and information on historic household formation characteristics based on those population characteristics, and then coming up with household numbers. We will forecast the number of households by demographic type, although I don't know how much detail we'll actually provide in the ABAG forecast, but we will be using that to then come up with income categories. And again, not traditionally forecast in the overall ABAG projection numbers, but in terms of doing the geographic distribution, we'll also have to be thinking about housing type and how the population that we're coming up with is likely to sort itself out, both between homeowners and renters and between single-family and multifamily households. And all of that will then go into the geographic distribution of these households. So there's a lot of variation in who could make up a household, and that can influence factors like household size. So, for example, over time, household size in the Bay Area has varied, and that's partly in regard to or in response to economic conditions. That doesn't look like a very big variation, but a tenth of a point in variation in household size can be a significant difference in the number of houses you need to accommodate the population. And then there are much bigger differences in household size among the different counties. And again, issues going forward. Why is that the case? Those of you who heard our State of the Region talk know that we have very different age profiles in the different counties. How will those change over the next 25 years? That can influence what a household size will look like. So then we take all of that information, the people, the jobs, the ability to drive to and from different parts of the region, costs, what are local policies, and all of that then goes into Urban Sim and gives us some estimates not only of the number of housing units, but where those housing units are. So that's, in a nutshell, the small job that we have ahead of us. I want to emphasize to all of you that this is a process that we're not doing alone, particularly when we get to the geographic distribution. And participation by the local jurisdictions in terms of providing us with data, reviewing our interim estimates, will be very important in providing a forecast that people feel is accurately reflects where our jurisdictions, our members, want the region to go. So here's our timing for this. Over the next 6 months, we'll be working with local jurisdictions to do a lot of data verification. Starting in the fall, the scenario concepts will have been developed, and jurisdictions will have a chance to review and respond to those. And during the winter and spring, we'll be crafting both the final forecast and the final scenarios, which then will go into the EIR process. So thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. We do have four speakers, but I think first we should probably take commission questions. Commissioner Eklund.
Thank you very much. I have two questions. One is, last time we had a difference between Department of Finance and ABAG's projections, and if you can explain a little bit about what we're going to do this time to not have a major difference, or at least to have an understanding of why there is a difference. The second question is when you talk about local verification and the influence of policies that jurisdictions may want to share with ABAG that will affect the population, housing, and jobs projections, to what extent is ABAG going to ensure that the elected officials are going to be engaged in that process and not just the planners?
Okay, I'm going to answer the first question, and I think I'll see if Miriam would like to answer the second. So the first question is about the difference between the Department of Finance and ABAG numbers, and what happened, we had then was a failure to communicate, in that the Department of Finance made their projection. They also use a cohort survival method primarily. And for migration, they simply took the rate that had happened in the previous decade. Well, that was a decade with two major downturns. So they were not taking into account the longer-term migration patterns and the likely differences in the economy going forward. We have now that happened at a time when ABAG was in a transition in staff, and there wasn't someone leading the process within ABAG. Now that I'm leading that process, we have been in touch with the Department of Finance. Their numbers now, their updated numbers, are very close to what we had in projections 2013. Of course, if we come up with a different projection, then that may require some more discussion with DOF, but they also update every year. So our intention is to remain in communication with them, and if there are differences, to try and understand why. Now, all that said, there are still differences in the current one at the county level. And they're partly, their interpretation of local policy is different than ours is. And so we understand why that's there. We've discussed that with them, and we'll take another look as we go forward.
About the engagement with local jurisdictions, we're working very closely with the planning directors as well as with the CMA planning directors and research team to verify existing data as well as to get input on the preliminary drafts. As in the last cycle, but with more support, we will ask planning directors to present the material to local council so they can engage. Local elected officials can engage with your own planning directors, and we'll keep bringing the material to this forum, to the regional planning committee, and to the executive board.
Thank you. Commissioner Liccardo, and then Commissioner Gupta, and then Commissioner McKenzie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I wanted to go back to slide 19. I thought this was somewhat startling, and I might be misreading it, so I just want to make sure I understand clearly. It's the population changes by ethnicity. I'm sorry, I'm looking at 19. Oh, no.
That one?
Nope. There we go. That's it. Yeah.
Complicated.
So just so I understand, I mean, as we look at that graph on the right about migration, I don't think I had believed or understood that ethnicity was such a major distinguishing determinant in migration patterns. I mean, certainly we all, you know, the city I represent, and I'm sure it's similar to other cities, we're much more diverse than we were 15 years ago, and we expect to see the growth in Latino and Asian American communities. But what is startling to me was what appears to be an out-migration of whites. And it seems not just recent, but for more than a quarter of a century. And I'm trying to understand that.
So let me clarify. This net migration number includes international. Okay? Now let's go back to this slide. We've had net out migration in every period domestically. But net in migration in terms of foreign. So what you're seeing here is that much of the migration-driven growth has been in immigrants who are primarily Hispanic and Asian. You have net out-migration not only of whites, but also of blacks. And that's the domestic out-migration that's happening. And I was surprised as well that it was as strong as it was. It's partly also age differences, that as the older population grows, over some periods people have cashed in on their value of homes in the Bay Area and moved elsewhere, not necessarily out of California, maybe to somewhere more on the outskirts or in the foothills. So that's a lot of this is age driven as well.
So to some extent you see the ethnicities as a proxy for migration within the country versus international immigration.
So Pitkin and Myers actually they estimate tendencies to migrate by age, by ethnic group, and by nativity. So that's how their model works, and this is what it adds up to, what it's added up to historically, but it's a function not only of ethnicity, but also of place of origin and of their age.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Gupta.
Thank you. Just following up on the previous question on migration, I wanted to go back the effort to make sure that our projections are consistent with each other, namely population, household, mm-hmm. employment, economy, etc. But I also want to emphasize the need to be consistent in migratory patterns with respect to our neighbors. Beyond ABAG region, there are other counties and other areas that may or may not have assumptions which are consistent with our assumptions of in-migration and out-migration. And I'd like to just underline that effort on the part of our forecasting activity to make sure that our efforts are in sync with regions outside ABAG region. That was number one. Number two, I wanted to make sure that in terms of labor force participation, we do include changing patterns of women entering the workforce now with respect to the next at least 4 years, if not 20 years in the future. So I'd like to make those two points to make sure that we pay attention and see if there's any discussion item on that. Especially in case of scenarios, we are talking about three scenarios. They may be, those two may be a part of a scenario development definition at that stage. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to respond to that, or are you?
Well, let me respond to the first question, because I want to make sure you know what we are doing to try and be consistent with what's happening around the beyond the Bay Area. So our economic model includes a component that's the rest of California. Now, that's not ideal. It doesn't then pull out the Stockton area, the Santa Cruz area, and so forth, but it does help us understand how changes in the Bay Area interact and are linked to changes in the areas surrounding the Bay Area, because certainly that sensitivity is going to mostly go to or come from our adjacent counties. And then the other thing is that at least for the Central Valley adjacent and nearby counties, we have been meeting formally and informally with those MPOs. And I just had another conversation yesterday with the economist from the University of the Pacific who is doing their forecasts. So that doesn't mean we're coordinating our forecasts yet, but at least we have the communication channels open to exchange information about them.
Thank you. And then on the other point, I guess we'll probably hear more about women's roles in the future.
Right. Well, I'd actually like at some point, perhaps offline, to hear more about specifically what considerations and questions you have.
Thank you. Commissioner McKenzie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jake McKenzie from Sonoma County. Just to follow up on Director Eklund's questions about checking in with locals, I would hope that as part of your program that there would be specific presentations made to each of the congestion management agencies, you know, where we all hang out as electeds, dealing particularly with the problems of implementing Plan B areas. So I would very much hope that there would be specific presentations made to TAM and SCTA and all that litany of acronyms. Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner Hagerty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pleased to hear Pradeep bring up the issue that I want to talk about. You know, my understanding is of why we go through all of this is we're trying to prepare infrastructure and make sure that we have the proper infrastructure available to handle the economy, keep the economy flowing, continue to move people, keep our roads safe, make sure, you know, that people have access and are able to move around our region freely. I think that I really want to try to be nice here, but I'm starting to get to a point where, unless I throw a desk over here, that people just aren't listening. And I think, you know, I have to be a bit of a cynic because I feel like there's projects that MTC doesn't want to do in, for example, the Tri-Valley. They don't want to acknowledge what is truly happening over there. And they're in gridlock. They're just flat out in gridlock. Truck traffic is supposed to triple over the Altamont in the next 20, 30 years. It's only going to get worse. And for us to continue to act like San Joaquin County, Stanislaus County, and others don't exist is absolutely ridiculous. And I'm hopeful that at some point, and I've looked through the staff report, I've tried to find, I know that you tried to answer his question, and this really is not an indictment on you. You just happen to be the presenter today. But I really don't see in here, and I know that you answered him about working with other jurisdictions outside of the Nine Barrier region, but I don't see anything here that really says that. And I get increasingly nervous that we continue to just hear, well, we're working with them. I'm going to tell you I don't believe it. And I don't, you know, maybe you all can start convincing me, but until I start seeing that we're looking at jobs that are migrating into the Nine Barrier regions on a daily basis, there are a significant amount of people, and allow me to be parochial, that come from Tracy and beyond on a daily basis to work in San Ramon, San Francisco, San Jose, and we continue to ignore them. We have to stop. We have to start looking at the people that migrate into Nine Barrier region because, quite frankly, Monday through Friday, 5 in the morning, 4 in the morning till 9, and then 3 in the afternoon till 7, those people are impacting our roads. And I am so tired of the fact that we continue to ignore them. We don't want to acknowledge they exist. We don't think they affect our air quality, which they do. I have to start seeing something in this plan that acknowledges this. And even in the minutes, I mean, I very politely, last time we met, and I'm sorry I was late. I was coming up from Monterey from a CalCOG meeting, which, by the way, on some of the population issues about immigrants and things like that, I think they will differ. With what we saw yesterday kind of differs. But at the last meeting, I mentioned, you know, can we please work with, you know, outside of the region? That's not in the minutes. Like, I didn't exist that day. And I was late for the minute. I was late when they approved the minutes, but I wanted to add that. but I didn't exist that day. And I'll talk for 20 or 30 minutes today to make sure that today I have some sort of relevance and that I exist and that we start to acknowledge the people that live outside of the Ninebury region that are coming here on a daily basis. I will stop now. I hope that ABAG and MTC have listened. And I hope that when we start seeing these presentations, we will start looking at workforce migration in and out of the Ninebury counties.
Thank you very much. I think it's a point well made, and lots of other things happening that will encourage us to do that, but I think we need to take some steps. Please.
I want to say thank you for your input again, and I hope that as we go out with the more detailed information on your area, that we will be hearing from you again on this, that this is part of your role is to feed in exactly this kind of information. So thank you.
I understand my role, but my role is not to continue to repeat myself.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Miriam, would you like to add to that?
I think we heard the point, and if I'm hearing correctly, we are not documenting the points, the work that we're doing in a way that recognizes the request that was made. And so I guess we can include it in the minutes and in the subsequent memo, the specific tasks related to the in-commute, related to the migration patterns with adjacent counties, and related to the meetings and collaborations on assumptions, which is the point that Pradeep made. How are we coordinating the assumptions with the adjacent counties? We'll document that in the next memo to see if that addresses your concerns or if there are if there's more specific analysis that is required. We're working, ABAC is working with MTC and getting first the very specific data on what are the commute patterns today, and we'll see to what extent we can document and analyze that in the future.
But Miriam, I think that, and excuse me for being a doubting Thomas, but I remember the settlement agreement that we made with one of the people who's one of the organizations that sued ABAG and MTC, and one of the settlement agreements was that we'll ignore anything that happens coming over the Altamont because it doesn't really exist and it will not increase above a baseline over the next 20, 30 years. I forget what it was. You know this better than me. So the settlement agreement in itself is what makes me extremely nervous that we're just going to continue to ignore these people.
Also, part of the settlement is a clear, transparent process. So we'll bring the ground, the information on the ground. We'll bring the analysis on the existing economic trends and the future trends that we are reasonably forecasting, as well as the policy dimensions and the legal settlement components of that for your discussion and deliberation.
And just to help prove my point, I would be more than happy to offer up the Livermore City Council chambers where we could have a meeting on a Thursday and maybe start around 4 and see how many of my colleagues show up late.
Can actually get there.
Or get there. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. Point well made. I see no other commission lights on, so I think we should proceed to public input. I have 4 people on the agenda. The first I received was Bob Glover from BIA.
Hi. Yeah, thank you very much. Bob Glover, Executive Officer with BIA of the Bay Area. I want to thank Miriam for the comments. I think you all have a letter before you that came from our legal counsel. It pertains to the settlement agreement between BIA and the two agencies. It deals with our concerns over compliance with the settlement as it pertains to this very issue. And so what would be helpful, and I respectfully request from the committee, would be some type of written, very brief written communication outlining how you intend to comply with the settlement as it pertains to this issue so that BIA and other impacted stakeholders can get involved in the process as it goes forward. I think simply saying that we're going to look at it in the fall, that doesn't provide a lot of direction or or assurance to us that it actually will be addressed, and we very much appreciate that. So thank you.
Thank you very much. The next person who wants to speak is Michael Ege.
Can we go in a different order?
Surely, you're all from BARF, I think,
right?
We
have sort of an orchestrated order.
We have three speakers from BARF, and you are?
Hi, my name is John Schwerk, and I live in San Francisco. I actually want to thank Scott. I don't know you, and I didn't know you were on this committee, but you provided a perfect segue to what we wanted to talk about today. And I kind of wanted to fulfill the role of introducing our group because we're a relatively new group, especially at the regional level. And I want to recognize that I see a couple of my supervisors here today, and I look forward to working with you guys in the city as well, where I'm sure you've heard of us. And the rest of you who aren't in San Francisco or Oakland and Berkeley will probably be hearing of us more in the future. The full name of our group is the San Francisco Bay Area Renters Federation. I know BARF gets a lot of giggles. It's also very useful for people to remember us when they hear it the first time, and we're a little bit of a punk organization, so it kind of fits our personality well. We're a regional organization that has been around a little less than a year to represent we're here today to represent the interests of employed people who do not own land and do not fit under the affordable umbrella, because either we make too little or we make a little too much money, or because there isn't funding enough to subsidize housing for everyone who makes less than 120% of the median income, which is kind of what we're looking at today, even higher really in the city, of people who are housing challenged and paying up to 40% of their income for housing. We would like to note that many people, even up to the 80th and 90th percentile in the Bay Area, are paying more of their income for housing than they should be. In addition, they're also paying 30% or more in taxes, because at a national level, they're considered to be rich, even though if you make $80,000 in San Francisco, you're actually not at all rich. And many of them have hundreds of thousands of dollars in student loans. So when you start to put these together, there aren't a lot of percentages of your income left to eat, to save for the future, to pay for health insurance if you happen to be self-employed, to pay for kids if you happen to have them or want to have them, etc. There certainly isn't enough money to pay for a $80,000 to $100,000 security deposit to get into the landed classes in our region, even if you make $150,000 a year sometimes. The chronic housing shortage has left people who didn't buy real estate 20 to 30 years ago, like most of you, pretty frazzled. So as I said, we just started about a year ago, and the last 3 months, and 3 months ago, we were less than a dozen people speaking at local planning meetings, often at the by-project level in San Francisco and Oakland, advocating for urban density and increased housing supply along the goals of Plan Bay Areas, increasing housing near transit, things like that. It's been an educational process for us to realize how all of that filtered up into this regional process and how much responsibility the member cities and groups represented at this table today have for the current housing shortage. Regardless of how much analysis and everything we do, and all apologies to you, because our presentation may come off as directed towards you because we happen to pick this presentation to talk at, but it's something we just want a serious, real serious look at how we calculate these numbers, because what they're going to eventually translate to is how much housing cities say they need to build. And we all know that because they make a lot more money from commercial and retail development and office development, no cities are jumping to build housing. No cities are jumping to build affordable housing at all, either any kind of housing, really. So, and that's where we get this in-migration from all the surrounding counties. That's where we get ridiculous spikes in prices due to housing shortages when people come into the new offices we're building and make $150,000, $200,000 a year, and that's what's happening. So in the last 3 months, we've grown into a group of over 200 active participants in our planning forum on the internet. We have meetings. We had a meeting this week where we actually talked about ABAG and the Regional Housing Needs Assessment and other alphabet soup things that have to do with regional housing plans. And you would have been surprised to see 35 people from San Francisco and Oakland and as far as San Jose attending that meeting to kind of study what your job is to get right. And we're most of us are not urban planners. There's a few of us that are architects. There are a few of us that are developers. We always get accused of being shills for developers. Anyway, I'll keep it brief. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that since there are three of you speaking from the same organization, okay. Maybe you're speaking for them. I don't know.
Sorry. Let me skip down to the end.
I think your time is about up, so if you want the others to speak.
I'm going to let our other speakers speak about the specific points, but we look forward to working with the member cities and staff of ABAG to provide relief to the chronic housing shortage, and we invite you to learn about us and communicate with us on our radically open planning forum on Google Groups. You can find it by going to sfbarf.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the party. Michael Ege, thank you.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to let us speak today. John was a good cop. I'm sort of the bad cop, at least based on my experiences. I'd like to preface my comments with some of the experience, some of the things I encountered working as a civil grand juror for San Francisco County last year and co-authoring a report on our affordable housing programs. I was really dismayed to encounter a local government that seemed to want to consign any growth or leeway for workforce housing, housing for people who work and earn salaries, to the domain of deed-restricted affordable housing. That is unthinkable to most working people, and it also violates the spirit and intent of those programs. I was dismayed to encounter staff members of Council of Government organizations, such as those represented here, who seemed to be more interested in advocating against more market rate housing, which we desperately need, and against the state policies which they are charged in their working lives with promulgating. I'm dismayed to have heard this presentation today and the implications that it has. Increasingly, organizations such as yours seem to be gaining the appearance of wanting to water down the actual urgency of what's happening, not only in terms of the affordability of our communities, but the environmental sustainability of our communities. And I just want to ask you to, again, it was gratifying to hear about the BAI settlement, because that's obviously something in the direction that we should be going to, and I ask that people be diligent about it. And also, again, look at the most recent Legislative Analyst Office reports, which I'm sure at least some of you are willing to acknowledge or is basically a restatement of a long-term problem that has become more and more urgent over time. And I also want to remind everyone here that we are the tip of the spear. We represent a growing disappointment with the increasing unaffordability of the Bay Area. Studios in San Francisco cost in excess of $3,000 a month now. It's ridiculous. And as this Bay Area becomes more and more unaffordable, our disappointment is going to turn into outrage. Thank you very much.
We have one more speaker, Michael Tsai, and if you could try to bring up points that have not been raised, that'd be great. We have a couple of other committee meetings to get to after this one, so.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome.
My name is Michael Tsai. I'm what many people might consider a techie. The term's been thrown around a lot. I have a lot of friends. They live around the Bay Area. They work really hard. Landed what they thought would be really well-paying tech jobs, but they're still finding that it's very hard to get a place and to stay in the place. And we're kind of new to this whole political thing, but we're about to get into it because we feel like there's a lot of disappointment that hasn't been adequately expressed. You know, for a long time, we've kind of been a big silent body, just sitting in our desks, writing code, and not really speaking out too much. But I personally get the feeling that we're reaching a point where that might change, probably will change. And I was told that I should not repeat things and bring up points that have already been brought up, which is fine. I remember Scott Hegarty saying that he didn't want to be here to repeat himself. But unfortunately, sometimes I feel like that's the position we find ourselves in when we run into what feels like it's kind of a stonewall. Myself, I studied economics at UC Berkeley. I know how to make economic presentations. I mean, I know how to make them cute. I also know all the little cute tricks that go into an economic presentation and how they can make things look very much unlike what they actually are. I know my time here is limited, so I think I'll spare the takedown, but I'm an economist. A lot of my friends are. A lot of them have experience in the tech industry, and I personally advise a lot of tech startups. And one of the big problems they face is that they can't get their employees housed at reasonable prices. And this is becoming a real pain point, and we're ready to take action. But anyways, thank you.
That's very valuable input. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I see that I have no other cards. I have one commissioner who'd like to ask something. Commissioner Ackland.
Thank you very much. I wanted to follow up on the public comments. Has ABAG or MTC looked at housing availability and the relationship to the cost of rent over time? And then that's my first question. The second question is, are we going to have some discussion about the BIA request at this committee? I'd like to understand a little bit more about that. So those are the two questions I have.
Would you like to proceed with the first question?
So we certainly track what's happening with rents. I think the speakers have really honed in on the issue of that's a broader issue for the Bay Area of housing for middle-income earners. And that's also a whole issue that was discussed but certainly not resolved by the Economic Prosperity Plan. So I would say, yes, it's definitely up there in our areas of concern.
Thank you. And on the BIA letter, my impression is that they're asking for more clarity on how we're going to deal with the settlement in over the next 6 months. Is that accurate?
So are we going to be able to see how we're going to address their concerns and have some discussion about it?
Yes, we'll be bringing to this committee, as well as the Regional Planning Committee and the Executive Board, the approach to address the legal settlement.
Thank you. We'll look forward to that. Are there any other questions that you'd like to raise? This matter is for information only right now, and so if we've exhausted it for the moment, we will come back to it in the future. So next on the agenda is – oh, Amy, sorry.
Yeah. No, thank you.
Commissioner.
Thank you.
Commissioner
thank
Worth.
You. And I think Commissioner Compton.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. I wanted to follow up on some of the public comments, and I'm glad that we're going to hear the discussions about how we're going to comply with our settlement commitments. We'll come back to this committee in a public setting, and we can understand it and discuss it. So I think that's important. I assume that'll be well before any methodology is finalized, so we start using it. But I think that some of the comments have brought up an issue that I kind of raised at the previous meeting that I'd still like to have more information about. And we are really challenged in the Bay Area with the lack of available and affordable housing, really at all income levels. And in Arinda, we just opened our affordable senior housing community, 67 units, and you know it took 10 years to put that together. We're very proud of it, but we recognized yesterday at the meeting the tremendous lack of, the tremendous needs in the Bay Area. And you look at seniors without any kind of equity are in big trouble to try to stay in the Bay Area because the cost is so high. But I think it might be very helpful to have a lot of this information broken down by kind of stages in life, because some of the problems that I'm finding with the general information is that that combines the, say, younger people in the workforce that are looking for jobs, that are looking for housing, versus those that have had a stable housing situation for, say, 25, 30 years. And I think it would be helpful for us to really understand sort of these critical issues at all levels. And my fear is, in reality, it's much more critical than what a general statistic might show with that, you know, kind of the baby boom group that's set in housing versus, you know, the younger generation that are really out looking for jobs and housing. So it would, I think it would be really helpful if you have that information. And also to find some of the issues that we deal with is the affordability by county, to see it not only for the region, but so we can understand within each county where, you know, the critical issues are and where opportunities lie in terms of providing housing.
So on the by-county question, Vital Signs has a lot of that if someone from a county wants to go in and look. And there is some comparative information at the county level. And I'm trying to remember if we put some at the city level on there. I'll take a look. The city's a little more challenging because the ACS data is like a five-year average. But there's definitely comparative data at the county level in the State of the Region report. On the question of by different age groups, that's, I think, a really valuable suggestion. We actually are in the midst right now of putting together a brief on senior housing patterns and senior housing choices. So we're taking the first step, but I think the speakers today have brought up the issue of younger age groups as well, which might be a next step.
Thank you. That would be really helpful to understand, have those statistics by age and cohort. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Campos and then Commissioner McKenzie, please.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to say something. And I want to thank staff for the presentation, and I think it's great work, a lot of information. And I also welcome the fact that we have this new group, BARF, that is coming forward. I think it's good to have dialogue. But I want to be very clear, even though they're presenting themselves as a group of renters, it's a group that has a very specific agenda that is actually funded by corporate interests that want to push forward this idea that if all you do is build, even if all you build is luxury housing, that somehow building housing for the wealthy and the ultra-wealthy will trickle down and will help the middle class and the lower class. And it's really supply-side economics and Reaganomics all over again. And, you know, people have a right to believe that. And it's one perspective, and it should be a perspective that's debated. But it is a perspective. It is a perspective that, from the perspective of what's happening out there on the ground, it hasn't worked, didn't work in the 80s, it's not going to work again. And their agenda is certainly moving forward the needs that have been outlined by corporate interests and also the developer community. And I think that there should be a debate on this issue, but it should be called out for what it is.
Thank you very much. Commissioner McKenzie.
I took the liberty of going on the website for SF Bay Area Renters Federation, and I noticed on their agenda for this morning that they refer to our committee meeting and in parentheses RENA numbers. My question, Madam Chair, is it's my understanding that RENA numbers are not going to be revised in this cycle. In fact, we are on an eight-year cycle. So the numbers that exist are the numbers that exist. And I would just make a little footnote to say that the problems we've had in the city of Roanoke Park, where we have granted permissions to developers for over 4,000 housing units to be added to a city of 40,000 people, the reason that these housing units have not been built, that they have not pulled permits, has been a reluctance on the part of the financial side of the business to come in and execute what they had asked for over the last 6 years, 6 to 8 years. So I'm not altogether happy when I hear these constant accusations, and this includes Governor Brown in Sonoma County saying, well, you don't want to build any houses. That's bullshit. Thank you very much.
In Scottish version. Commissioner
Translation
Lewis.
Supplied on request.
I was happy to hear the comments today because I think they reflect reality, that it is extremely difficult for our young people to pay rent and work despite their high salaries, that we really do face a problem of the middle class being squeezed out. I think my experience has been deed restricted affordable housing is both opposed by local communities. It's very difficult per square foot to build. It's much more expensive than market rate. That wealthy people will always get to live where they want to live, regardless of whether you build their housing or not. And that the most effective way to create housing is to build to the market. And then address the affordable needs in other programs, such as our work proximity housing, where we've got 55 low to moderate income families in home ownership in Napa. As a result, using existing housing that are welcomed in the neighborhood. I think we really need to refocus and re-examine the model that we have used over the years, because it's not working, and look at how we address the issue of housing and affordability, recognizing that what we've done in the past is not working.
Thank you. Ken Kirky, please, you'd like to fill us in on Rena, I bet.
I'm actually just going to make a point of clarification for the next meeting, as much as this conversation is just the beginning, and we'll have many like it going forward for Plan Bay Area. In part with that in mind, the Operations Committee has requested that they go first in May, because these meetings tend to go rather long. So I just want folks to keep that in mind, that this joint meeting will be second for the month of May.
Thank you very much. And I think that if there are no further comments, Commissioner Pierce would probably like to conclude the ABAG minutes.
I would like to do that. And since we did achieve a quorum, and thank you all for making it, I would like to ask the ABAG Admin Committee for approval of the summary minutes of March 13.
I'll move the second motion.
Have a motion by Hagerty, a second by Eklund. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain? That passes unanimously. Thank you very much.
So unless there's further business for the Planning Committee, I would accept a motion to adjourn, or adjourn with no objection. If there is no objection, seeing none, we shall adjourn to the Operations Committee.